Ah, Michael, he said in his rueful voice, not make them angry. The pilot moved with gentle speed over the spitting waves. Our ride through the wind and drizzle had an almost sinister softness, and instead of running like devils, we chugged and slopped along until a wave caught us. The propeller whined, and we stranded suddenly on the beach. But Kylie, Abdenasser, and a few other pirates crammed us into a Land Rover. The moon-tinged clouds were marbled and heavy. We drove along familiar paths to Mussolini's farmhouse and parked beside another vehicle, but we had to wait while two Somalis climbed onto the roof of the other car and held their phones up, as if to sniff the air for drones. This tactic baffled me. I'd never seen it before Ahmed Diriye's mysterious effort a few weeks earlier. Drones could pick up cell phone signals, but could it work the other way around? While my brain spun for an answer, Bakile grinned at us from the front seat. His whole presence felt unquiet and cruel. His character lacked a moral break, any glint of compassion. He said something in Somali and made a flying gesture with his hand. The pirates in the Land Rover laughed. Tomorrow you will get your plane ticket home, one of them translated. Chapter 13. In the morning, Raleigh and I found ourselves crammed into another car with more gunmen driving through the dusty bush to the west of Hobyo. A pirate named Dag sat next to me, ruminating on stems of cut, sometimes allowing his mouth to hang open. Dag could brood for ages with an occasional dreamy smile like a wistful girl, only to come up with some foul remark. "Michael," he said, "you must ask your family to send money, otherwise the pirates will sell you to Al-Shabaab." "Well," I told him, "you have to lower your demand." "How much are they asking?" "They," as if Dag were not a pirate. "20 million. "I think they will accept 10 million, Dag said. "How sensible." Camels grazed in the scrub outside. Their rear ankles had been fettered by nomad owners, and when we zoomed past, they would lift their noses and make awkward hops away from the car. Furry wild hogs also scurried through the dust.
"Michael! Rolly!"
cried Bakile from the front seat, pointing at the black and white bush pigs, which to my poor eyes looked like underground dogs.
"Come!"
cried Bakile.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Raleigh muttered. The cars wound toward a sloping, wooded area, where other cars and other Somalis waited under the trees. I had never seen this place before. Raleigh mumbled that he and Mark had lived here once, in a shady washout which later flooded.
"We call it the river," he said.
We parked under some trees, and the guards marched Raleigh away behind a thicket where unknown Somalis had gathered.
"Don't worry," Dag told me. "It is not Al-Shabaab."
I squinted at him. Something weird was going on. They moved me to a more luxurious SUV, outfitted with video screens in the headrests. We sat around while Somali pop videos played like entertainment in a waiting plane. Stiff dancers, awful processed synthesizers, and I had time to think that bush pigs were ugly animals, that I might not eat pig either if I lived in this part of the world. Then a phone rang. A guard rolled down his window, and we heard a harsh voice cry out.
"Rolay!"
said Abdenasser the Sahib, and the pirates led me to a cluster of tangled trees where a group of men stood or squatted in the dust. Some wore turbans and kefiyas, all held long weapons, and I spotted Bakile, Ali Dulai, Ahmed Diriye. A gathering of pirate bosses? Or a convention of bosses, clan leaders, and investors? They watched me for a reaction with wary eyes, like predatory cats. I didn't understand at first. They were waiting. On the other hand, something worse waited, something more malevolent that they wanted me to observe. Raleigh dangled upside down from a tree.
"Oh, fuck," I said.
He swung free in a pair of cotton shorts. His arms flopped like a rag doll's. They'd tied him by the ankles to a heavy bough. A plump, deep black man with a high voice whacked him on the chest and feet with a bamboo cane. It was a torture scene from old Islamic memory, when Ottoman officials used to tie the feet of criminals and subject them to bastinado, or public foot-whipping. Two teenagers filmed it. Other Somalis ran up to kick Raleigh in the ribs with their dusty feet. They seemed to enjoy it. Raleigh didn't scream again. He closed his eyes and let it happen, and I wondered if he was in shock. The plump man, Garfanji, handed his cane to another Somali and came up the slope. He squatted some distance away from me and glanced up with his peculiar squint.
"Hello, Michael. Do you remember me?" Yes, Mohammed. Your friend Raleigh is being punished.
What for?
I said. He will not say he is Israeli. The idiocy hurt my head.
Well,
I said, he isn't Israeli. I have found proof on the internet, Garfangi answered.
The man with the cane slid it through the cotton knot at Raleigh's feet and used it to turn his whole body this way and that while other men kicked. I was about to point out that Raleigh spoke no Hebrew, but that could have led to an awkward line of questioning.
Have you been to Israel?
I had. So I decided to say, he speaks like a man from the Seychelles. This answer was no use to Garfangi. He said nothing. I had to wait while Dulai harassed my friend with a lit cigarette. He held the filter into Raleigh's upside-down face and spoke with a mocking smile. He tried to slip the cigarette between Raleigh's lips.
No, Ali. You know I no like cigarettes,
Raleigh said, but Dulai was grinning. The other Somalis went on with their torture in a bizarre and listless way, running up to kick him or trading blows with the cane as if they could think of nothing else to do. The Somalis were like boys who'd found something to engage their casual cruelty on a weekend afternoon. I marveled at how thin an excuse any man needed to treat another like a piece of meat. Dulai took the cane and whacked Raleigh in swift, sharp blows on his exposed chest, his stomach, his thighs. The cane left fading marks on his light brown skin. Raleigh winced but kept silent. Even when Bakayle made taunts about his ransom,
"We will get $50 million from your family,"
he pretended not to hear. But from that day on he would refer to Bakayle as 50 million. At last the pirates lowered him to the dirt. Raleigh lay on his side, propped on one elbow to gain his breath.
"I want you to counsel him," Garfangi shouted at me. "Explain to him that it will be better if he admits that he is from Israel."
I went to sit near him and asked two Somalis for food and water. Abdunasser brought a bottle and a box of biscuits. I welled up with pity and fear. I had no idea what to do.
"Are you hungry?"
I said, and Raleigh nodded.
"These men have gone crazy, Raleigh. They think you're from Israel."
He shrugged. One of the teenagers photographed us.
"Try to relax for a while," I said. "I think it's over."
The fear and helplessness were so extreme and so contradictory that I sank into a dark and peculiar calm. It was like the moment when Dulai shook his pistol in my face. After the mortal shock, I found a strange, ice-cold balance. I returned to where Garfangi squatted, and he said that these men, the turbaned bosses, wanted to know why no one had wired my ransom. The demand for my hide was still $20 million.
"I want my money," Garfangi blustered.
"You're asking too much," I said quietly. "Even you know that." He bellowed my answer to the assembled pirates, who hollered their dissatisfaction and shook their weapons. They held machine guns, grenade-mounted rifles, and AK-47s. One looked like Mustaf Mohammed Sheikh, the pirate Ashwin and I had interviewed in Hobyo. He kept a kifye wrapped around his face, so it was hard to tell, but the resemblance chilled my blood. Garfangi said I would be sold to Al-Shabaab in 1 hour if the money wasn't sent immediately.
"They are coming here now," he said.
He was lying, but he was in command. I felt a mixture of fear and ashen contempt.
"We don't have the money," I said. "There just isn't that much money available." "You're lying," he shouted. "I have looked into your bank account. I know how much money you have."
It was true that his men had stolen a bank card. I didn't know if someone had hacked the account. But I said, "So you know I don't even have 1 million, Mohammed," and that tripped him up. Garfangi had an image to maintain. Any answer he gave would upset his projection as an all-seeing, all-demanding crime lord. Either he knew we weren't rich, or he didn't. He couldn't be all-seeing as well as honest. I watched him carefully, and from the way he dissembled, I gathered he had not cracked my account.
"The American government hasn't given us any answer," he said. "How can we find more money?"
"You have my German passport," I said. "Maybe the German government can help." I didn't think it could, but I was surrounded by armed men and had to say something. Garfangi hollered my answer to the others. They shook their weapons in approval. Garfangi suggested a video. The whole episode from start to finish was pirate theater. Garfangi's theater of cruelty in the woods, and while the teenage cameraman adjusted their tripod, a few pirates stepped behind me, quietly, holding heavy weapons. I didn't notice them at first. Other pirates insisted I wear a blanket over my head to disguise me from aerial surveillance.
"This blanket?"
"Huh? Yes."
It was the pink flowered blanket I carried everywhere. I also wore a pink tank top and bright green soccer silks. I hadn't shaved in weeks. I was grimly aware that in the video I would look not just wretched but ridiculous. I draped the blanket over my head, and soon Garfanji played the inquiring journalist, shouting from behind the camera. "What are you requesting from the government?" he said. "I have to request, from the American or the German government, the full ransom," I answered, as rehearsed. "Which government especially will pay?" "The German government? And how do you want it to pay?" "They need to give an answer within 3 days," I said. "Is there any problem if they do not pay?" "Yes. If there's no answer, the kidnappers here will sell me to Al-Shabaab." Afterward, I sat on the ground and watched Garfanji mount a rise of alluvial soil to address the men. He'd pretended to mediate between the hostages and this wild gang of bosses. Now he rose to his true role as their chief. He swung the bamboo cane and pontificated. He reminded me of Jack from Lord of the Flies. Tyrant was too big a word. He was a play tyrant, a sadistic bully removed from any government or power to contradict his nasty will, and he introduced me to the real meaning of anarchy, where justice and reason, the conceits of civilization, just evaporated like a fog. I watched Garfanji rave. I strained to understand his speech, and in the afternoon light streaming through the trees, I noticed for the first time how this pirate lord, this high-voiced, overweight child, had flecks of gray in his hair. The young cameramen packed their equipment. After Garfanji's speech, they paused in front of me to apologize. One had small, wire-frame glasses. He looked idealistic and spry and spoke decent English. "We can't do anything here," he said. "We are only journalists. We will put these videos on the internet." "What for?" I said. "We will tell people about your plight." "This wasn't journalism," I said, with a gesture at Raleigh. "It was humiliation." The young Somali adjusted his glasses and said, "Humanitarian, yes." I squinted at him. There was no way either boy could have reached this corner of the bush without a clan connection to the pirates. I didn't believe their story. Humanitarian was also a special word in places like Somalia. It stood for the UN and the Red Cross, for Médecins Sans Frontières, for all the organizations that provided a link to the greater, more merciful world. "That's not what I said," I told him. Chapter 14. The pirates loaded Raleigh into a car and led me up a dusty incline away from the trees. Garfanji said it was time for a phone call. He tapped my chest with his bamboo cane and swore that if my family didn't send $20 million in 3 days, I would be sold like chattel to the jihadist beasts. Other bosses, including Dulai and Ahmed Dirye, sat in the dust around a big thorn bush, aiming their rifles at my head. "Mohammed, I'm cooperating," I said. "Why are you acting like this?" That tripped him up, too. He had no response when I acted reasonable. He scrolled through the list of contacts on his phone and found my mother's number, pressed call, and handed it to me. Her contact name on the screen was Habar Gallo, mother of the infidel. "Hello?" said the infidel's mother. "Mom," I said, "the men here are threatening to sell me to Al-Shabaab within 3 days if they don't get their money." "Okay," she said, playing it quite cool. Garfanji repeated his demand for a letter of absolution from the president. "It must be signed by Obama. It must have a White House seal." "How should she send it?" I asked. "She can send it by email," said the pirate boss. "You can just mock something up in Word," I mumbled into the phone. "Oh," said my mother, who would have been coached on this question by the FBI. "I don't know if we can do that, Michael. That would be forgery." "Tell her the demand is still $20 million," Garfanji said. "What is her counteroffer?" Mom answered, 8,000? Maybe we could go up to 10. The distance between the two offers made me dizzy, but I felt proud of my mom. It was the only serious response. "She says 10,000. "Oh, now she is joking," said the pirate. "She thinks you're joking," I blurted. "Can I call him back at this number?" Mom said. I hesitated. The question implied caller ID. It didn't seem wise to tip off Garfanji to the fact that she could see his number. He bellowed again about 20 million, so I skipped her question and said, "He says the whole amount has to be wired to Somalia in 3 days. All 20 million. "Can we call him back at this number?" she repeated. I glanced up. "She wants to know if she can call you back at this number." "What does that mean?" Garfanji hollered and began to lose his mind. "Is she tracing this call? How does she see my number?" He took the phone and roared that I would be sold to terrorists. 3 days, he cried. "Not 3 months. 3 days. He ended the call, dismantled his phone, and flicked out the SIM card. It was a small and fiddling gesture that proved tricky for a pirate lord to accomplish with real diabolical finesse. The card fell into the dust, and he used his sandaled foot to stamp it over and over to ensure that the mother of the infidel would not be calling him back. A sail to Al-Shabaab was on the dark edge of my mind before and after this call, but as long as the groups were at war, I thought it would remain theoretical. Garfanji had assembled a private militia around Hobyo in part to protect his business interests from Al-Shabaab, and I was one of those interests. The jihadists also claimed to oppose piracy for religious reasons. But that was like saying Somali pirates were just poor fishermen. Al-Shabaab probably did profit from pirate ransoms by taxing the gangs in regions where they coexisted. Would they reverse the flow of money and strengthen the pirates to nab an American? An asset sale like that was hard to imagine, but not impossible. We returned to Mussolini's farmhouse in the late afternoon. Mark was there, and around dusk the pirates served us a large platter of rice. We weren't allowed to talk. My fork trembled in my fingers. I felt enraged and confused. I expected to be driven far into the wilderness that night, maybe back to the wooded valley with the hoarse-voiced vultures. Around sunset, while storm clouds massed like dark cliffs over the sea, Dulai appeared in our doorway with a rifle on his shoulder. "How are you, Rolly?" "Fine," he said, and smiled like a hyena, hoping to joke away the bitterness of the horrible afternoon. "I am fine," he added, and I think this odd phrase came from Somali English primers, an answer parroted from grammar class, which Rolly was supposed to parrot back. "Q, how are you?" "A, I am fine." I wanted to shoot Dulai with his own Kalashnikov. Rolly gave a feeble, ironic, grandfatherly chuckle. But when the pirate left, we prepared our beds for the night on the floor, and in the fading light, Rolly gave his own interpretation of the grammar lesson. "Me? I want to die," he said. Part 5. Flight. Chapter 1. My mother's professional cool on the phone was deceptive. "Of course I was freaking out," she would say later. The call from Garfanji woke her up before dawn, and she knew little about Al-Shabaab. She had no way to assess the pirates' threats. FBI agents arrived at her townhouse later the same morning with a laptop. They sat around the mess on the dinner table and reviewed the conversation. "The FBI told me, don't get all stressed. First of all, the pirates and Al-Shabaab hate each other, so the terrorists are not about to pay the pirates any money." Whenever the FBI paid a visit, she served coffee and bagels, and whenever a meeting or a phone call had been scheduled in advance, she ordered sandwiches. Later, she baked banana bread and cookies. She'd started to think of the agents as surrogate family. One of them, named Steve, said, "She was so incredibly generous, in spite of what was going on, we had to tell her just to stop, because she would have done that every time we came over." Steve lived about a mile away in Redondo Beach. "There were times," he said, "when there was nothing going on, and I would go over there to check in and just talk about other things, to keep her somewhat focused on trying to take care of herself, and make sure she was keeping busy." Mom had made an agonizing decision to keep my case quiet in the news. At her instigation, Der Spiegel asked for an embargo on the story from American and European outlets, and the result was a near-total news blackout on stories about my case. The logic went that hostages made famous by coverage became more expensive. Whenever negotiations faltered, though, so did Mom's faith in the tactic, and sometimes she warned negotiators and officials around her that she wanted to tell the world. I'd call up and say, "Steve, I'm going to go national," and then he would come over and we would discuss the possible outcomes. The point of big publicity in a hostage case is to exert pressure on a sluggish or recalcitrant government. Since the U.S. and German governments had both mobilized, Mom decided to keep quiet. The final decision was always hers, so I don't question it. But the embargo failed to shorten my stay in Somalia. As long as I had a radio, I listened for clues about my case, and it seemed curious that the World Service never mentioned it, even during reports about Somalia. Part of me felt isolated and forgotten. I had no idea what was going on. But I also knew that publicity would give leverage and comfort to my kidnappers. My guards even listened to the radio like eager kids whenever we made a video. They wanted to hear my name. They looked forward to a media circus, and it frustrated them to hear nothing. While Mom reviewed the first video in the first week of May, Steve and the other agents pointed out that I looked alert and decently fed. I wasn't starving. I had to speak under duress, but the bristle of machine guns and grenade launchers made the agents laugh. I mean, it looked so horrible and so scary, but it was meant to intimidate, Mom said. They would say, look at how they're pointing their weapons. This is all staged for optimum effect on the family. That's how we watched every film. I made 5 proof-of-life videos in Somalia. The first one came up for sale in mid-May. A Somali sent an email to Ashwin in Germany offering the footage for $2,000. Ashwin declined. Instead, it wound up later the same month on Somalia Report, a news site which broke the embargo. It became the single well-known clip from my time as a hostage. Chapter 2. Raleigh and I drifted to sleep in Mussolini's farmhouse while a storm broke outside. Through the window, we could see lightning flash over the ship in piled banks of blackening cloud. Around 9 o'clock, the pirates woke us up. Come on, they said, but I balked at the idea of driving off in a storm. You've got to be kidding. Go, 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 go! Rain pattered the tin roof of the gloomy Italian ruin. I climbed into the Land Rover, feeling depressed and convinced the pirates would drive us to some distant corner of the bush to make us miserable in the storm, if not to sell me to Al-Shabaab. Instead, we went speeding through the damp white sand on the Habio waterfront and stopped in front of a skiff. We boarded like before in warm, slapping waves. Lightning flashed over the Nahan 3, but our pilot didn't rush. He still had standing orders to keep his speed down, so we chugged gently through rocking swells in the rain. Returning to the ship quelled my terror of starting a new chapter as a hostage. I suppose because the familiar scenery was reassuring, but I also had a strange optimism about escaping somehow at sea. I liked the ocean. I felt halfway to freedom out there, and I would be easy for surveillance planes to track. No one on the ship had expected to see us again. There was a flurry of excitement on the work deck before we retired to our cabins. When I woke in the morning, around 6, the Filipinos had made coffee and some wads of celebratory fried dough. I sat on the fiberglass bench and noticed the creak of a cricket under the damp floorboards. A gray dawn light had spread across the ocean, and I was just wondering whether the cricket had sailed from Mauritius with the Nahan 3 or somehow hopped its way from the Somali mainland when Tony said, "Helicopter this morning, Michael." "Really? Half an hour ago," he said. "What did it do?" "It circled the ship only." I told him what Garfangi had done on land. The story spread among the Filipinos, and by the time Raleigh came down the steps before breakfast to sit in our corner, it was like the advent of a wounded king. He found his tin mug and accepted coffee from Ferdinand. "How do you feel?" I said. He shook his head. "Me? I hurt, Michael." The other men woke up and stowed their bedrolls. We spread our mattresses under the conveyor belt, and Raleigh rested for a while. When he told the story himself that morning, he seemed to relive each humiliation with the stick. "Bap, bap," he said. "They think I Israeli. This fat man, he think he finds something with his computer." Raleigh's face looked wooden. "Me? Israeli?" We spent the rest of the day in a state of relief, sitting under the conveyor belt and watching the crew toss out fishing lines. Raleigh gave me the Creole names of the fish that came over the side. Some were exotic to me, including groupers, spangled emperors, humphead snappers, and rainbow runners. But the most common fish were the karang, a small, yellow-spotted trevally, and the inedible scavenging remora, which clung to the sides of the ship and cleaned up scraps of anything. Raleigh watched with such a yearning professional interest that I said, "Don't you want to fish?" "Oh, me, I like to fish," he said. "At home, I go to fishing because it make me happy. You understand? But I no like to remember that here." I understood very well. We'd learned to hood ourselves in Somalia, to starve and blunt our pleasures, to protect ourselves from madness. Under the rising heat on the ship, I remembered my dad's passion for fishing, his motorboat on a trailer in the driveway, and his eagerness to drive it up to a reservoir in the mountains north of L.A., where he could waste an afternoon in the hot sun with a beer waiting for trout. Mom and I went with him, normally, but we couldn't appreciate the solemn need to keep silent on the boat, which seemed as important for my father's nerves as it was for the fishing project. Mom would chit-chat, impishly. Dad would say, "Shh, you're scaring the trout," and Mom and I would giggle. Good Christ, I missed my family. But I no like to remember that here. "Now we on the ship again," Raleigh remarked after a while. "You feeling better?" "Yeah," he said, and gave a dismissive wave. Chapter 3 After the early helicopter visit, I made a point of waking up around 5 every morning because the prospect of jumping for a helicopter at that hour when the pirates were drowsy and the sun cast blue shadows on the landward side of the ship gave me hope. I would be harder to see in the half-dark, harder to shoot, and I looked forward to taking the pirates by surprise. The Filipinos kept a plastic alarm clock near their wok and electric kettle. I asked Tony if I could take it to my cabin at night. He said yes, but after I had done it twice, one of the Chinese-speaking crew objected. He was an older man with a potbelly and melancholy eyes, an alternate engineer, actually from Taiwan. The crew called him Tajo. He didn't seem to get along with the Filipinos or with Li Bohai, the first engineer, who had pounded my back into shape when I first came onto the ship. I tried to explain why I wanted the clock, but Tajo didn't understand. When I continued to borrow the clock, he stopped the generous favor of taking our bowls before each mealtime to serve us food. At last, I quit using the clock. But Tasho's objection signaled something more important. We were no longer guests aboard the Naham 3. After our return from land, we had joined the hostage crew. Our rights to the captain's cabin also disintegrated. When Ture left on shore leave, a Somali we called Big Jacket shut down our bathroom privileges. Big Jacket was a skinny guard lieutenant who wore an oversized blue blazer in every kind of weather. He didn't like having to muster his men to attention whenever we climbed the stairs, but it bothered me to lose even a small and petty freedom to such a low-ranking guard. "They're just making up rules," I grumbled to Raleigh. "I not care," said Raleigh. "I shower with soap water, like the children." He didn't say no shower, he said no toilet upstairs. I glanced at Raleigh. "You're giving up too easily. These guys are just lazy." "This man, Big Jacket," he said. "Yeah, Big Jacket," I smiled at the name. "He thinks he runs the ship, but he got the gun." After lunch that day, Raleigh undressed near the front of the deck and took a cold saltwater shower. It made an impression on the crew. I still resented the pirates' arbitrariness, so I copped an American attitude of protest. When Big Jacket disappeared to another part of the deck, I took my bright yellow towel and went up the stairs to demand a shower. The baffled guards let me go. As a team, they didn't know their own rules. "There, see," I said when I came back down to the work deck, toweling off my hair, "completely arbitrary." "Yes, Michael. Now you go up there alone," Raleigh said and looked away. "Oh, come on, you could go up there too. I'm just saying we can challenge the pirates' rules." "Me? I take saltwater shower," he said with a kind of bitter pride. He had a point. An American attitude of protest was also an attitude of privilege. Looked at from the right angle, and marching upstairs with a bright yellow towel sent the wrong message to the non-English-speaking crew, who might have wondered why the Americans still got to use their murdered captain's facilities. So I started using the saltwater hose the next day. The steady, urgent flow of lukewarm brine didn't clean your hair and skin exactly, but stripping naked for a few minutes and getting wet broke up the boredom of a standard afternoon. Chapter 4 Without a clock in my cabin, I learned to tell time by the color of the sky. Somalia is near equatorial, so the sun rises and sets around 6 all year round. I fell asleep by 8. The ship would rock, and I would doze in nervous catnaps until 4:30 or 5 when the dark sky turned blue outside my window. By 5:30, an orange stain had spread on the horizon and I got up. A Somali gunman sat in the bridge to watch for movement in the corridor, and with his permission, holding my foam mattress and my pink-patterned blanket awkwardly, I picked my way down the hall, outside to the steel stairs, down to the deck. The swaying boat and narrow stairs were tricky with the mattress. I sometimes lost my balance, and sometimes the big thing caught the wind like a sail. I didn't care. It was conscious and deliberate. I moved the mattress back and forth like an idiot to flag the attention of drones. I thought a man lugging his foam mattress up and down the stairs of a tuna boat, wearing a flowered pink blanket on his head, at a predictable hour, twice a day, might become easy to track from the sky. Before 6 o'clock a.m., the air felt quiet and damp. I heated up water for coffee in an electric kettle and took a spoonful of Nescafe from a can. I mixed it with sugar and powdered milk while the crew snored, and I waited. Around 6, the nighttime guard shift changed over to more alert Somalis, and every morning before it happened, I hoped for the distant chop of a helicopter. I would have been off the deck like a cannonball. Raleigh came down from the cabins by 6:30, followed normally by Ha, who was comical in the morning because he never tried to spruce up. He just looked like crap until he had his coffee and cigarette. He also made an amusing game of bumming the cigarette by leaning against one of the Chinese men and holding his hand like a beggar, as if to admit to himself that his desire for nicotine was degrading. I don't know why he never had his own pack. The ship had a vast supply of cigarettes. Every couple of days a man came out of the freezer, brushing frost off a new carton, and passed out hinge-topped packs like candy. No one seemed to bother about running out, although everyone knew the ship's provisions had a limit, like the ship itself. We understood the omen of the Shifu One on the shore. Another cabin sleeper who came early down the stairs was a Chinese officer, Chiang Quan. We nodded at each other as he settled on the fiberglass bench, still wrapped in a thin blanket, and we taught each other to say good morning in English and Chinese. The crew had an English-Chinese dictionary, a fat little cube of important information, which became a subject of contemplation for me, like the Bible. "Good morning," Chiang Quan had learned to say in clear but halting English. "Zhao Sheng Hao," he had taught me to say, and then he would correct my intonation. "Zhao Sheng Hao," I would repeat. Again, a correction. "Zhao Sheng Hao," I would say, and Quan would hold up his thumb. Quan had a paunch and a growing bald patch on his round head, which made him look middle-aged. In fact, he was 37. He smoked with a stony, comical, phlegmatic gaze as if nothing surprised him. He was first mate, a rank higher than Li Bohai, but he rarely asserted himself. Li Bohai had assumed everyday leadership, maybe because the pirates preferred to deal with him. No one cared. The hijacking was too absurd. Quan had quit. He smoked cigarettes with Li Bohai and with another engineer named Cao Yong. Those three were the leading cadre, the most experienced men. From our halting conversations, I learned that Quan came from a rice-farming province of China, and no one in his family, not his wife and kids, not his parents, understood the problem in Somalia. The crazy demands by pirates on the phone were like noises from a distant star. The Chinese kept a paper calendar, and each wide sheet gave a Western and a Chinese date. Tasho and Jian Zui maintained it. By June, there were near-daily arguments about the actual date, which led to scuffles in the corner by the Honda motor. Accurate or not, a page from the calendar drifted around the deck as a ritual from one man to another while we gathered for morning coffee on the bench. Sometimes I kept it to scribble on since I missed my notebook. Sometimes Ha, with his hair in a messy pompadour, cigarette dangling from his lips and curling smoke in his eyes, folded the sheet into a tight paper plane. He moved to the edge of the boat to launch it over the sea, and we watched it loop around, caught by an air current, and glide over the morning glass, which at the right hour was touched with bronze patches of wavering light. The plane would fall and stick to the surface of the water, like a flying insect newly captured in sap. We might, or might not, stand up to watch it sink. Chapter 5. One morning in May, I used the Chinese dictionary to converse with Cao Yang, the wiry second engineer. He had the angriest energy of all the Naham 3 crew and seemed the least beaten down. He hated the pirates, but he did his work, which sometimes included repair trips to the engine room. Part of the ship's engine ran as a generator day and night, and I'd learned to appreciate the steady thrum as an indicator of our comforts on the ocean. It had started to spit and falter. The freezer hold, the kitchen, the filtration system for drinking water, nothing ran without the cycling generator, and if it gave out, we would have to move ashore. Along with my fantasies of escape, I dreamed up a collective mutiny. The story of a suicidal hostage from the Xiufu One haunted me every day. 15 months, Hamid had said. Maybe that was some kind of limit. I'd been a hostage for almost 4, Raleigh about 7. The crew had been captive for 2.5. We had free use of steel fish knives on the work deck, as well as whetting stones, marlin spikes, and a sharp fishing gaff, a hook mounted at the end of a 12-foot bamboo pole. I brooded about these weapons and tried to guess the number of pirates. 30, at most? 1 for each hostage? Of course, we lived on this forward deck by design. The pirates could be anywhere on the ship, and we weren't supposed to count them. Cao Yong, I said, and flipped through the dictionary. When I found a word in English, I pointed to the Chinese character, and he nodded. We built up phrases that way. Life on land no good, I suggested. Cao Yong nodded. I came to the point. Should the crew attack the pirates? It was a dangerous idea, but not out of the question. It needed Chinese leadership. The Somalis were superfluous on the Naham 3. Cao Yong, Li Bohai, and Cheong Kwan were not. Then again, none of us had military training, and the ship was possibly hobbled. Cao Yong took the dictionary. Very dangerous, was his reply. I nodded. He flipped through and showed me further English words. Pirates do not kill. Eventually, they release. I worried about death or suicide on land, but that was too elaborate, too conjectural to explain. Cao Yong flipped through the pages again and found the Chinese character for a single, conclusive phrase. Not worthwhile. I nodded and shrugged. Chapter 6. Every afternoon, when Chat arrived in a skiff, the Somalis would shuffle back and forth upstairs, like cats about to receive a treat. They lined up to receive their rations, and Big Jacket came to the upper rail to summon Tasho, because Tasho and several other hostages had developed fledgling habits, out of stress or boredom or both, and the pirates donated half a bundle every day to their corner of the deck. Tasho hustled out in nothing but a pair of red shorts and returned, clutching his bundle, with a comical, mournful, baffled expression of need. "Is happy hour," said Raleigh. One Cambodian who chewed with Tasho was intense and reedy, and he mouthed off in a way that inspired abuse from the Chinese, who punched him in the arm when they grew tired of his comments. His name was Nyem Soshan. He and Tasho had been close friends of the dead captains. They had enjoyed certain privileges while the Naham 3 was in regular operation, and now Soshan complained in a braying voice about the pirates and refused to do much work. After a while, I realized he raised his voice during shower time to make loud, sarcastic appraisals of the size of each man's cock. That was one reason they slugged him. These stress fractures in the muted, quiet society of hostages on the Naham 3 came slowly into focus. The hijacking had shifted a balance of power on the ship. It was a Chinese-dominant vessel, so the Chinese speakers and their friends were used to feeling privileged. But English became more important after the hijacking. "The Somalis think I am the crew chief," Arnell said. "I'm not. I'm just a crewman. But I speak English, so I became the translator." "You got a promotion," I said. Arnell laughed brightly. "Yes." Raleigh and I had gravitated toward the Filipinos because of their English. Skiff deliveries of mango juice and vanilla cookies came only for me, the expensive hostage, and I tried to distribute them fairly, but side benefits tended to pile up in the Filipino corner. So the Chinese and their allies gained the impression that extra bottles weren't for them. One hot morning, Sosan protested his maltreatment in a reedy-voiced, sarcastic but also comical diatribe, complaining about the Filipinos and the Chinese and the Somalis and the food on the ship and the American and the lack of mango juice for Sosan. I handed him my last bottle, but he shook his head, electrically aware that I wanted him to shut up. Instead, he made fun of my pale skin and my pointy nose. The rest of the crew grumbled with uneasy laughter. No one knew what to say. And Sosan continued in a mixture of ship's pigeon and Cambodian until I shouted, "Cambodia, saite! Cambodia, loco loco!" That Cambodian's crazy. Everyone laughed, including Sosan. Of course. Insults blew off steam. Later, Sosan and I would be friends. Several days after this tirade, we heard Tasho complain in Chinese. He sat in his corner by the Honda motor, while Li Bo Hai sat near us on the bench and listened over a smoldering cigarette. Li Bo Hai was an arbiter of justice on board. He tried not to take sides among national cliques. After a while, he brayed back in Chinese. "What's the matter?" I asked Tony. "They are arguing about coffee." "What about it?" The whole crew acted chastised. Tasho complained a little more. Tony said the main complaint was that coffee in the Filipino corner had disappeared too quickly. "Well, that's because of us," I said. "Shh." Tasho stood up, as if he wanted to fight. Li Bo Hai stood up in response. Instead of climbing over to grapple with Tasho, though, the chief engineer darted to a closet in the work area. "Heh!" he shouted, and tossed out a packet of tea. "Heh!" he shouted, and tossed out a box of Abu Walad biscuits. "Heh!" he shouted, and returned to the sunlit deck to empty a plastic jar of tea packets and other hoarded food. Tasho fell silent, like the rest of the crew. Li Bo Hai sat down again on the bench. "Those are Tasho's things," said Tony. "He says Tasho should not complain so much about the coffee." Chapter 7. Apart from these outbursts, it was hard to tell how everyone coped with the constant strain. Our anger should have been directed upward, at the pirates, but it tended to slop sideways, back and forth, like acid in a vat. Most of us, no doubt, fell back on religious training, but our ship's pigeon kept us from indulging in sustained philosophical conversation. 4 Indonesians were Muslim, a 5th was Christian. The Cambodians and Vietnamese were Buddhist, and sometimes I saw Fumani, the tattooed man with bowl-cut hair, chant rapid Buddhist prayers at the back of the work area. The Chinese might have been Buddhist, or Taoist, or Confucian. When I thought about the man from the Shifu One who'd killed himself, I wondered how Buddhists regarded suicide, and this question reminded me of Thich Quang Duc, the Buddhist monk who'd famously doused himself with gasoline on a Saigon street corner in 1963. He had wanted to protest religious inequality in South Vietnam. The most striking aspect of the photo of his fiery death was his erect posture, his look of evident calm. A student at the University of California, San Diego, imitated Quang Duc in 1970 to protest the Vietnam War, but instead of remaining on the pavement in monkish serenity, George Wynn Jr. jumped up to run, flaming across a wide plaza. Before he died in the hospital, several hours later, he said to his mom, "I believe in God and the hereafter, and I will see you there." I didn't want to die like that. The promise of a hereafter didn't spark my imagination. Quang Duc had shown a deeper religious instinct. Buddhism promises no personal afterlife, no survival of individual consciousness, and I figured any man who could sit unflinching without the prospect of heaven while his robes and body burned had learned to loosen the bonds of selfishness and desire. There was no other yardstick for philosophy or religion from my point of view. I lined up with Albert Einstein. The true value of a human being is determined by the measure and the sense in which they have obtained liberation from the self, he wrote in a letter in 1934, and by this brilliant, simple formulation, even our devoutest pirates were imbeciles. Raleigh put it another way, while we sat under the conveyor belt one morning. He watched the pirates bumble around on the deck while they unloaded a supply skiff, refusing to help one another out, like clowns. Raleigh was the closest thing to a philosopher we had on the sweltering work deck, and, knowingly or not, he paraphrased Socrates. "They're not evil, Michael," he said after a while. "They just not know." Chapter 8. One day in June, Abdul the translator came aboard wearing a Hawaiian print shirt over his printed Indonesian sarong, with a pair of sunglasses, maybe to shield his eyes from the confusion of patterned cloth. He disappeared upstairs for a while. In the late morning, he came down to sit on the bench and ordered Tony to fry him a fish. He also loaded a few wads of tobacco-like dry tea straight into our electric kettle, where it would stain the plastic. instead of parceling it out into mugs as we did. And before everything boiled, he used a hammer and a piece of cloth to crush two plump cardamom pods he had carried in the pocket of his shirt. "This is how you're supposed to drink it, with a little spice," he told me. "It's how my mother made tea when I was young." He poured out a fragrant cup and handed it to me with one of his flare-toothed smiles. "For the boss," he said. "No, no." The whole crew watched. Some of them resented what he had done to the electric kettle. There was also not enough spiced tea to go around.
"Just take it, man. It's good."
"What for?" I said. "Just taste it, then. I'll drink the rest. It ain't poisoned." I took a sip and handed it back. "Not bad."
"Okay," I said.
Why was he buttering me up?
"We're gonna do a phone call tonight to your mother," Abdul said at last. "The boss is unsure. They gave me permission to handle your case."
He found a scrap of cardboard.
"Do me a favor and write down your phone number and your mother's name."
I did so.
"I think we're gonna get somewhere," he said.
I'd never made a phone call with Abdul before. My mind began to churn. Would he recognize German? His English was better than Garfanji's. The pirate master spoke an orotund, almost Kenyan colonial English, but Abdul's had an edge of American slang, which was odd.
"Where'd you learn to speak English?" I asked him.
"Right here, in Somalia."
"Have you ever been abroad?"
"No, man, I haven't been out of the country."
"Hmm."
Later, a Somali guard came down to distribute supplies. He handed out shampoo, detergent, and cigarette lighters. When the lighters appeared, the work deck pounded with bare feet. Every man from behind the conveyor belt rushed the unsuspecting, unarmed pirate. Tony returned from the scrum with a new LED lighter. He knew I wanted one, since my last LED had burned out, so I dug through my stash of things and produced the old lighter with less fuel, and traded it, along with two bottles of mango juice, for Tony's high-end equipment. That evening, Abdul came to sit next to me and said,
"Okay, tonight we're gonna call this guy in Norway. He's gonna wrap up your case. Somali guy. Just answer his questions. Don't say anything else."
"Sure." I waited for more.
"Why is he in Norway?"
"I don't really know."
At sundown, the hostages assigned to cabins filed upstairs for bed. I spent an hour wide awake on my bunk, wondering what to say on the phone. I wanted to request a helicopter in German. We hadn't seen a helicopter since before our video shoot with Garfanji. The sky in the meantime had been suspiciously, perhaps deliberately, quiet. We sat in the dining booth in the hallway across from the captain's cabin to make the call. Pirates manning the bridge used this table for lunch and dinner. They ate with their hands, without napkins, so there were dried formations of scraped-off pasta and rice on the table's edge.
"These guys are disgusting," Abdul said.
He dialed a number and hesitated.
"If he asks about your location, tell him you're in the bush."
I nodded. He connected the call and spoke rapid-fire Somali, with the volume up loud enough for me to hear the other man. His Somali sounded as rapid and strong as Abdul's, so it surprised me, when I took the phone, to hear a Scandinavian speaking fluid English. I'll call him Anders. He asked a few basic questions, and I gathered that he was a private negotiator, just opening a file.
"When we finish here," he said, "I will talk to your mother. Do you have any message for your mother?"
The false hope Abdul had sparked by lying about Anders incensed me. I blurted in German that I was on a ship. Abdul grabbed the phone and hung up.
"Who was that guy?"
he asked, and my eyes must have widened in astonishment.
"He's a mediator. I thought you said he was going to settle my case."
"He's from the media?" Abdul said.
Astonishing. I was ready to smash furniture. Abdul was a complete idiot.
"A mediator, Abdul. Jesus, he's a negotiator, just like you. He's in your fucking line of work."
The general ignorance that had me stuck out here on the water made me want to punch him. My kidnappers weren't even good kidnappers.
"Did he ask your location?"
he said.
"No,"
which was true. I returned to my cabin but couldn't sleep. The generator thrummed and the Naham 3 rocked like a duck in a tub. I thought about Abdul's concern over our location. He'd ordered me to mention the bush, most likely, because he wanted American planes to look for me inland from the Habio cell phone tower, which would be traceable from Abdul's number, but might have many miles of range, rather than out at sea. In German, I had said Schiff, not Naham 3 or Habio, but no other ships lay nearby. I'd said enough. Someone could figure it out. Before I fell asleep, I remembered my lighter from Tony. My porthole stared east, across the open ocean, so pulsing signals through it wouldn't alarm Somalis in Hobyo. I rooted in my bag for a roll of toilet paper to shield and direct the light as I had done on land, and started flashing SOS into the black, intractable sky. Chapter 9. A monsoon started to rock the ship in mid-June, a constant wind which raised heavy chop on the water as well as storms of reddish dust over Hobyo. The sun set every evening like a white puck in a smudged ochre painting. "We call it the southeast," Raleigh said, which hinted at the mutability of the season across the Indian Ocean. Trade winds shifted direction over the Seychelles during a summer monsoon, bringing drier weather. They dumped warm rain on Mumbai. They delivered cold nights and squalls of rain to Somalia. They also changed the ocean temperature. Until the monsoon, our saltwater showers on the ship were almost luxuriously warm, but in the first days of summer, the stream pouring from the pump felt like snowmelt. My skin twitched, and I tried to imagine how it would feel to jump off the ship. The notion of escape was always there, and on some days during the monsoon, I worried about hypothermia.
"It's like South Africa," said Raleigh.
"Sommer is winter."
"But for a different reason," I said.
"Yes, but we got June now," said Raleigh. "And Somalia is cold."
"Right, but it really is summer in Somalia. South Africa's below the equator."
"Yes, but in summer, Michael, South Africa is also cold."
"Because it's really winter."
"It's like winter now," Raleigh said.
The Seychelles lay below the equator too, but that didn't matter. We enjoyed bickering. It passed the time. The Filipinos referred to us as Tom and Jerry. These petty confrontational exchanges were also a way to ignore our situation, and in the afternoon I read in the Bible about the unforgiving servant, a man who found himself released by his king from a great debt. He walked from the palace to the street and collared another servant for not paying a much smaller debt. The king summoned him back to revoke his act of mercy. "So likewise shall my heavenly Father do unto you, if ye from your hearts forgive not every one his brother their trespasses." It was a chastening, awful thing to read in captivity. That day, or the next, a delegation of pirates came down to discuss a construction project with Li Bohai. Arnell translated while an old and damaged-looking Somali inquired about building a platform across the tuna tray from the middle of some unused stairs at about chest height, like a bunk bed. Somali guards had complained about the cold at night. The idea was to let them sit halfway downstairs, out of the monsoon wind. I objected in passionate silence. The platform would take precious bench space away from the hostage crew. The damaged-looking man had ragged hair and a stoop. He acted mean and ruthless, and he looked near 60, as old as Captain Ture. I thought of him as a rough old soldier because he seemed to have military training, but otherwise I knew nothing about him. He noticed my silent protest and gave me a filthy look.
"That man not like you," Raleigh said.
"The feeling's mutual." I objected to the wooden platform for another reason. I still wanted to jump. On the phone with Anders, I had missed my chance to request a helicopter, but I still hoped for the sound of chopper blades on some quiet morning. I felt guilt-ridden and restless every day. I wanted to do something to make up for the grief and horror at home. I wanted to restore the lost harmony of my old life, of all the pleasures I had time to recall. And I knew that if Somalis sat down here on a new platform, they might shoot a leaping hostage even before he left the ship. The Chinese also saw this construction project as a threat to our seating arrangements. They responded with an act of passive-aggressive arts and crafts. They ripped up some pulp novels from their luggage and folded Mandarin-printed pages into little origami cranes. They tied the cranes to lengths of fishing line, which they strung along the steel wall and the overhead deck. Every Chinese man knew how to fold an origami crane, somehow, but it still took 3 days of diligent effort before the port wall of the deck bloomed with 6 rows of paper birds, all cream-colored and fluttering in the wind, like blossoms on a garden bower. "I see the Chinese make deco," was how Raleigh put it. "I think it's a protest," I told him. He stared for a while at the strange and delicate creation.
"Look like somebody gonna have a wedding," he said.
Chapter 10. Living on the Naham 3 made me weird in the head. Along with a quick temper, I developed a strange lassitude. The salt wind, the persistent rocking, the elements, the damp and the cold, and the blazing sun seemed to soften my hold on reality, and I fell under the hypnotic influence of the open sea. The idea of jumping to freedom was half crazy. But was it crazier than staying on a pirate ship? I felt restless but salt-eaten, and my reflexes had slowed, which could be dangerous because, as a hostage, I sometimes had to think about enormous and sudden piles of vague information. Abdul returned to the Naham 3 at the end of June, and I asked how negotiations were going.
I haven't heard anything new.
Last time you said the man in Norway was going to wrap up my case. These guys on shore, he said, nodding toward Habyo and referring to the pirate bosses. They're not hearing what they want to hear. Money was on offer, in other words, but they had refused.
I see.
Abdul and I had to lie to each other with strategy and persistence. He was like a diabolical tax inspector who probed for hidden income. It's a mistake to mention any amount of money to a kidnapper, so I dodged his questions, but I nodded along with his cover story that he was not a pirate. He painted a picture of his role as a freelance negotiator, a man in business for himself, who drifted among gangs and tried to free hostages around Somalia. He provided a service. He did have more freedom than the pirate guards, possibly more disengagement from a single gang, but I believed Ferdinand's story about the mock execution, and I knew very well that Abdul was a pirate. The same evening, a Saturday, after we retired to our cabins, I used the captain's bathroom to brush my teeth. Abdul had slumped on the captain's bunk to watch TV. When I came out of the tiny room, he said, "Sit down here. I want to talk to you." I leaned on the edge of the bunk while he snapped off the television. "We're gonna do a phone call in a couple of hours," he said. "I just wanted to explain. Every time I get an offer from your side, I gotta bring it to this committee of bosses on land. They're crazy, you know. They're mean guys, and they're not getting any offer that's even close to what they want." It sounded as if negotiations had nudged forward, so I said, "Well, how much is their demand right now?" 20 million. "That's completely insane. If I want them to come down," he said, "I gotta hear something a little more in line with what they want." "You haven't done any work, have you? It's been a month." "Write down your email addresses for me," he said, "and your passwords."
"What for?"
"Aw, don't be suspicious. I won't give the passwords to anyone else." "You are anyone else," I pointed out.
"I'm trying to help you."
I took the pen and made a show of trying to remember my details. "I don't know everything by heart," I said, and wrote down a fake address. "But the password's obsolete. You guys have held me too long. It won't work anymore." Abdul glanced at the paper. The pretended friendliness vanished.
"So you won't give me your passwords," he said ponderously.
"Okay. When we talk on the phone later, you gotta beg for the money. Pour on the emotion, right? Because we're not getting the offers we need." I went back to my cabin and rehearsed a clear description of my location at sea in German, as well as a request for a helicopter. I decided that whoever might listen to the call, military intelligence, the FBI, would need time to translate my German and work out a plan, so tomorrow morning might be too early. On the other hand, we couldn't wait too long, since Abdul might record the call. He might notice the German and have it translated. I tried to imagine the consequences. My panicked, sea-softened mind raced, but came to no conclusion. I decided to request a helicopter for Monday morning. Abdul summoned me after an hour, and we dialed the number to Norway. The negotiator Anders asked about my health and my diet. I told him nothing had changed.
"Okay. I'm going to connect you with your mother. We'll all be on the phone together."
"Fine." My mother answered the phone, sounding deeply concerned for my welfare.
"Michael, how are you?"
By now, she would have seen the Garfanji video, and I wondered if she'd seen pictures of Raleigh hanging from a tree.
"Are you eating enough?" she said.
"Nothing has changed," I said. This refrain, repeated with feeling, meant, "I'm still on the ship."
"Can we send you a care package?" Mom said,
and I almost lost my composure. Abdul made a rolling hand gesture as if to say I should crank up the rhetoric, and I expressed alarm that no one had talked the figure down from 20 million. I grew emotional. I raised my voice and started to holler in German. Abdul grabbed the phone and clicked off.
"No, you can't do that," he said. "I don't know what you're saying. I was telling them I needed help."
"Say it in English."
He dialed Anders again and made the move it along gesture. I yelled about negotiations and money and my own desperation on land in Somalia. I added a quick line in German about the ship and glanced at Abdul. No response. The way to speak German, I realized, was to weave it into English. He couldn't recognize short fragments. So I blew some more smoke in English and blurted, Ich bitte einen Hubschrauber, Montagmorgen halb sechs. I'd like to request a helicopter for 5:30 this Monday morning.